The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 14, Side 1. I had also brought out with me, and still keep, my number patches. Am I the only one? In some homes they will be shown to you like holy relics. Once I was walking down Novoslobodskaya Street, the Butyrki prison, parcels reception room. I went in. It was full, mostly of women, but there were men too. Some were handing over parcels, others standing and talking. So this was where our parcels had come from. How interesting. With an air of complete innocence, I went over to read the rules, but a fat-faced sergeant major marked me with his eagle eye and strode toward me. "What do you want, citizen?" His nose told him that this was not a man with a parcel, but a man up to tricks. Obviously, I still had a convict smell about me. "Should we visit the dead? Your own dead lying where you too should be lying, run through with a bayonet?" A.Y. Olenyev, an old man by then, went in 1965. With rucksack and stick he made his way to the former medical section, and from there up the hill, near the settlement of Kerki, where the burial ground was. The hillside was full of skulls and bones, and nowadays the inhabitants call it Bone Hill. In a remote northern town, where there is half a year of daylight and a half year of night, lives Galya V. She has nobody in all the world, and what she calls home is one corner of a nasty, noisy room. Her recreation is to take a book to a restaurant, order wine, and spend her time drinking, smoking, and grieving for Russia. Her best-loved friends are cafe musicians and doormen. Many people who come back from you-know-where conceal their past. I am proud of my life story. Associations of former Zeks gather once a year, varying the place from time to time, to drink and reminisce. "And strangely enough," says V.P. Golitsyn, "the pictures of the past conjured up are by no means all dark and harrowing. We have many warm and pleasant memories." Another normal human characteristic, and not the worst. "My identification number in camp began with Yeri," V.L. Ginsberg rapturously informs me, "and the passport they issued to me was in the ZK series." You read it and feel a warm glow. No, honestly, however many letters you receive, those from Zeks stand out unmistakably. Such extraordinary toughness they show, such clarity of purpose combined with such vigor and determination. In our day, if you get a letter completely free from self-pity, genuinely optimistic, it can only be from a former Zek. They are used to the worst the world can do, and nothing can depress them. I am proud to belong to this mighty race. We were not a race, but they made us one. They forged bonds between us, which we, in our timid and uncertain twilight, where every man is afraid of every other, could never have forged for ourselves. The Orthodox and the Stoolies automatically removed themselves from our midst when we were freed. We need no explicit agreement to support each other. We no longer need to test each other. We meet, look into each other's eyes, exchange a couple of words, and what need for further explanation? We are ready to help each other out. Our kind has friends everywhere. And there are millions of us. Life behind bars has given us a new measure for men and for things. It has wiped from our eyes the gummy film of habit which always clogs the vision of the man who has escaped shocks. And we reach such unexpected conclusions. N. Stolyarova, who came from Paris of her own free will in 1934, into the trap which bit off the whole middle part of her life, far from torturing herself and cursing the day she came, says, "I was right to defy those around me, to defy the voice of reason, and come to Russia. Without knowing a thing about Russia, I understood intuitively what it would be like." At one time, I.S. Karpunj-Chpraven, then a fiery, successful, and impatient brigade commander in the Civil War, did not bother to examine the lists put before him by the head of the special section, but simply took a blunt pencil and jotted down at the bottom, not the top of the page, H.M., small letters, not capitals, and without periods, as though it was a triviality. H.M. meant highest measure of punishment, for all of them. After that he was promoted, and after that he spent 20 years and a half on the Kolyma, and next we find him living on a lonely piece of land in the middle of the forest, where he waters his garden, feeds his hens, makes things in his carpenter's shop, does not petition for rehabilitation, uses foul language about Voroshilov, fills exercise books with endless angry answers to every broadcast he hears and every newspaper article he reads. But a few more years pass, and the farmyard philosopher thoughtfully copies this aphorism out of a book. It is not enough to love mankind, you must be able to stand people. And just before he died, he wrote, in words of his own, but words so startling that you wonder whether they belong perhaps to some mystic or perhaps to the aged Tolstoy, "I have lived and judged all things by their effect on me, but now I am a different man, and I have stopped judging things in this way." The remarkable V.P. Tarnovsky simply stayed on the Kolyma after serving his sentence. He writes verses, but sends them to nobody. Verses like these: "My life is set in this far place, and lived in silence by God's will, for I have seen Cain face to face, and could not bring myself to kill." Truth demands that I add what happened later. He left the Kolyma and married unhappily. He lost his spiritual equilibrium and does not know how to get his neck out of the noose. The only cause for regret is that we shall all die off one by one, without achieving anything worthwhile. Freedom has something else in store for former convicts: reunion with family and friends, reunion of fathers with sons, of husbands with wives. And it is not often that good comes out of these reunions. In the 10 or 15 years lived apart from us, how could our sons grow in harmony with us? Sometimes they are simply strangers, sometimes their enemies. Nor are women who wait faithfully for their husbands often rewarded. They have lived so long apart, long enough for a person to change completely, so that only his name is the same. His experience and hers are too different, and it is no longer possible for them to come together again. This is a subject which others can make into films and novels, but there is no room for it in this book. Let me tell just one story, that of Maria Karatskaya. "In the first 10 years, my husband wrote me 600 letters. In the next 10, just one, and that one made me wish I was dead. When he got leave for the first time after 19 years, he went to stay with relatives, and only came to see me and my son for 4 days on his way through. The train by which we expected him was taken off that day. After a sleepless night, I lay down to rest. I heard a ring. A strange voice said, 'I want to see Maria Venediktovna.' I opened the door. In came a stout, elderly man in a raincoat and a hat. He walked right in without saying a word. Still half asleep, I had forgotten for the moment that I was expecting my husband. We stood there. 'Don't you recognize me?' 'No.' I could only think that he was some relative of mine. I had a great number of them whom I had not seen for many years. Then I looked at his compressed lips, remembered that I was expecting my husband, and fainted. My son arrived, and to make matters worse, he was unwell. So there we stayed, the three of us, for 4 days, never once leaving my one and only room. Father and son were very reserved with each other, and my husband and I hardly had a chance to talk. The conversation was general. He told us about his own life and was not a bit interested to know how we had got on in his absence. As he went back to Siberia, he said goodbye without looking me in the eye. I told him that my husband had died in the Alps. He had been in Italy, where the Allies had liberated him." There are, however, reunions of a different and more cheerful kind. You may meet a warder or a camp commander, At the Teberdinsk Tourist Center, you suddenly recognize physical training instructor Slava as a screw from Norilsk. Or Misha Bakht suddenly sees a familiar face in the Leningrad gastronom, and the other man notices him too. Captain Gusak, commander of a camp division, is now out of uniform. Wait a bit now, wait a bit. Didn't I see you inside somewhere? Oh, yes, I remember we took your parcels from you for bad work. He remembers, but all this seems natural to them, as though they have been put in charge of us forever, and the present stage is just a short interval. You may, as Belsky did, meet your unit commander, Colonel Rudiko, who hastily agreed to your arrest to spare himself unpleasantness, also in civilian clothes and a neat fur cap, with an air of scholarly respectability. You may also meet your interrogator, the one who used to strike you or put you in to feed the bugs. Nowadays he is drawing a good pension, like Kvat, for instance, who interrogated and murdered the great Vavilov and now lives on Gorky Street. God save you from such a meeting. It is you again who will suffer a blow to the heart, not he. Then again you might meet the man who denounced you, the one who put you inside and is obviously flourishing. For some reason heaven does not rain thunderbolts on him. A prisoner who returns to his native place is bound to see those who informed on him. Listen, why don't you bring a case against them? Some hot-headed friend will urge him. At least it would mean public exposure. And, at most, as everybody knows... No, I don't think so. Let's leave things as they are, the rehabilitated prisoner will answer. Because to bring such a case, you would have to begin by harnessing those 100 oxen. Let life punish them, says Avenir Borisov with a shrug. It's all he can say. That lady over there, L, a member of our union, once put me inside, said K, the composer, to Shostakovich. Make a written statement, Shostakovich angrily suggested, and we'll expel her from the union. Don't bet on it, though. K waved the thought away. No, thank you. I've been dragged around the floor by this beard, and I don't want any more. But is it just a matter of retribution? G. Polev complains that, when I came out, the dirty swine who landed me in jail the first time very nearly got me put away again, and would have pulled it off if I hadn't abandoned my family and left my hometown. Now that's how it should be. That's our Soviet way of doing things. Which is the dream, which is the ignis fatuus, the past or the present? In 1955, Efroimson took Deputy Prosecutor General Salin a whole volume of criminal charges against Lysenko. We are not competent to deal with that, Salin told him. Address yourself to the Central Committee. Since when were they not competent? Or why had they not admitted as much 30 years before? The two false witnesses who put Chulpenyov in the Mongolian hole, Lodzovsky and Seryogin, are both flourishing. Chulpenyov went to see Seryogin in the Consumer Services Bureau of the Moscow Soviet, together with someone they had both known in his unit. Let me introduce you. He was with us at Kalkin Gol, do you remember? No, I don't. A fellow by the name of Chulpenyov? Do you remember him? No, I don't. The war scattered us in all directions. So you don't know what became of him? I haven't the slightest idea. Oh, you lousy bastard, you. There's no more to be said. In the district party committee, which has Seryogin on its books, it can't be true. He's such a conscientious worker. Conscientious worker. Nothing and nobody has budged. The thunder growled once or twice and passed over with hardly a drop of rain. No, things are just where they were, so much so that Y.A. Krinovich, the expert on languages of the far north, went back to work in the same institute, the same sector, with the very people who turned him in and who still hated him. With these very same people he hangs up his overcoat and sits around the conference table daily. It has been aptly said of him that whereas some members of the People's Will Party achieved fame as philologists, thanks to the freedom they enjoyed in exile, Krinovich preserved his fame in spite of Stalin's camps. Even on the Kolyma, He did his best to study the Yukagir language. It's rather as though the victims of Auschwitz and their former overseers set up a fancy goods shop together. There are Obergruppen Stoolies in the literary world, too. How many lives is Y. Ellsberg destroyed, or Lesyuchevsky? Everybody knows about them, and nobody dares touch them. Efforts to have them expelled from the Writers' Union came to nothing. There was even less hope of getting them dismissed from their jobs, or, needless to say, from the party. When our criminal code was being drawn up, 1926, it was calculated that murder by slander was 5 times less serious and blameworthy than murder by the knife. And anyway, it was unimaginable that under the dictatorship of the proletariat, anyone would resort to such a bourgeois weapon as slander. Under Article 95, a wittingly false denunciation or deposition aggravated by A, accusation of a serious crime, B, motives of personal gain, or C, the manufacture of evidence is punishable by deprivation of freedom for not more than 2 years, and it can be as little as 6 months. The drafters of this article were either complete idiots or only too far-sighted. My guess is that they were far-sighted. At every amnesty since then, the Stalin amnesty in 1945, the Voroshilov amnesty of 1953, they have remembered to include those sentenced under this little article to look after their most dedicated helpers. Then, of course, there are statutory limitations. If you are falsely accused, under Article 58, there are no time limits. If you are the false accuser, there is a time limit, and you will be protected. The case against Anna Chebotar-Tkach and her family was a patchwork of false depositions. In 1944, she, her father, and her 2 brothers were arrested for the alleged murder, allegedly for political reasons, of her sister-in-law. All 3 men were done to death in jail. They wouldn't confess. Anna did 10 years. The sister-in-law turned out to be unharmed, but another 10 years went by with Anna vainly pleading for rehabilitation. As late as 1964, the reply from the prosecutor's office was, "You were convicted by the due process of law, and there are no grounds for review." When, in spite of this, they did rehabilitate her, the indefatigable Skripnikova wrote a petition for Anna, asking that the perjurers be brought to trial. USSR public prosecutor G. Terekhov answered, "Impossible because of the time limit." The same Terekhov who would conduct the case against Galanskov and Ginsburg. In the 20s, they dug up, dragged in, and shot the ignorant peasants who, 40 years earlier, had carried out the Tsarist court's sentence of execution on the Narodovoltsi. But those mujiks were not ours, whereas the informers are flesh of our flesh. Such is the freedom into which former Zeks are released. Look where you will, is there any historical parallel? When did so much generally recognized villainy escape judgment and punishment? Why should we expect anything good to come of it? What can grow out of this stinking corruption? How magnificently the wicked scheme of the archipelago has succeeded. Part 7. Stalin is no more. Neither repented they of their murders. Revelation chapter 9, verse 21. Chapter 1. Looking back on it all. We never, of course, lost hope that our story would be told, since sooner or later the truth is told about all that has happened in history. But in our imagining, this would come in the rather distant future, after most of us were dead. And in a completely changed situation. I thought of myself as the chronicler of the archipelago. I wrote and wrote, but I, too, had little hope of seeing it in print in my lifetime. History is forever springing surprises, even on the most perspicacious of us. We could not foresee what it would be like, how, for no visible compelling reason, the earth would shudder and give, how the gates of the abyss would briefly, grudgingly part, so that two or three birds of truth would fly out before they slammed to stay shut for a long time to come. So many of my predecessors had not been able to finish writing, or to preserve what they had written, or to crawl or scramble to safety. But I had this good fortune, to thrust the first handful of truth through the open jaws of the iron gates before they slammed shut again. Like matter enveloped by antimatter, it exploded instantaneously. Its explosion touched off in turn an explosion of letters that was to be expected, but also an explosion of newspaper articles written with gritted teeth, with ill-concealed hatred and resentment, an explosion of official praise that left a sour taste in my mouth. When former Zecs heard this fanfare from all the newspapers in unison, learned that some sort of story about the camps had come out, and that the journalists were slavering over it, their unanimous conclusion was, "More lying nonsense, nothing safe from those crafty liars." That our newspapers, with their habitual immoderation, might suddenly start falling over each other to praise the truth was something no one could possibly imagine. Some of them were reluctant to risk soiling their hands on my story. But when they started reading it, a single groan broke from all those thousands, a groan of joy and of pain. Letters poured in. I treasure those letters. Only too rarely do our fellow countrymen have a chance to speak their mind on matters of public concern, and former prisoners still more rarely. Their faith had proved false, their hopes had been cheated so often, yet now they believed that the era of truth was really beginning, that at last it was possible to speak and write boldly. And they were disappointed, of course, for the 100th time. "Truth has prevailed, but too late," they wrote. Even later than they thought, because it had still by no means prevailed. There were also some sober people who did not put their names at the end of their letters, "I must think of my health for the little time left to me," or who asked point blank, while the journalistic adulation was at white heat, "Why, I wonder, did Volkovoy allow you to publish this story? Please answer, I'm worried in case you're in the punishment cells." Or, "Why haven't you and Twardovsky both been put away?" Because their trap is jammed and failed to work, that's why. What, then, must the Volkovoys do? Take up their pens like the rest, write letters themselves, or refutations in the press. And indeed they proved to be remarkably literate. From this second stream of letters we learn their names and how they describe themselves. We had been looking for the right term for so long. Camp bosses, camp personnel. No, practical workers, that was it. Golden words, these. Czechists was somehow not quite right. Practical workers, that's the term they'd prefer. And they write, "Ivan Denisovich is a toady, Vivi Olenik, Act Yubinsk. One feels for Shukov neither compassion nor respect. Y. Matveyev, Moscow. Shukhov was rightly convicted. What should a Zek be doing outside anyway? V.I. Silin Sverdlovsk." These sub-men with their shabby little souls were dealt with too leniently by the courts. I feel no pity for people whose behavior during the Fatherland War was dubious. E.A. Ignatovich, Kimovsk. Shukhov is a highly skilled, resourceful, ruthless scavenger, the consummate egoist living only for his belly. B.D. Uspensky, Moscow. Can this pensioner be the Uspensky who murdered his father, the priest, and made a career in the camps on the strength of it? Instead of portraying the destruction of the most loyal citizens in 1937, the author has chosen 1941, when it was mainly self-seekers who landed in jail. What he means is simple people, non-party members, prisoners of war. In 37 there were no Shukhovs, and people went to their deaths in grim silence, wondering why anyone needed all this. What deep thinkers they were. Incidentally, they weren't as quiet as all that. They died with endless professions of regret and pleas for mercy. On conditions in the camps. "Why give a lot of food to those who do not work? Their energy remains unexpended. I say the criminal world is being treated far too gently. S.I. Golovin, Akmolinsk. Where rations are concerned, we shouldn't forget one thing, that they are not at a holiday resort. They must atone for their guilt with honest toil. Sergeant Major Badzunov of Oymyakon, age 55, grown grey in the camp service. There are fewer abuses of authority in the camps than in any other Soviet institution. I can affirm that things are now stricter in the camps. V. Karakhanov, Moscow area. This story is an insult to the soldiers, sergeants, and officers of the MOOP. The people are the makers of history, but how are the people portrayed here? As screws, blockheads, idiots. Bazunov. We, the executors, were also human. We were also capable of heroism. We did not shoot every fallen prisoner, and by not doing so, risked our posts. Grigory Trofimovich Zhelezniak. Zhelezniak claims to remember me, too. He arrived in irons, and he was a notorious troublemaker. Later, he was sent to Zhezkazgan, and it was he, together with Kuznetsov, who headed the rising. In the story, the whole day is filled brimful with the negative behavior of prisoners, and the role of the administration is not shown. But the detention of prisoners in camps was not the cause of all that happened in the period of the personality cult, but is simply connected with execution of the sentence. A.I. Grigoriev. The guards did not know why any particular prisoner was inside. Karakhanov. Solzhenitsyn describes the whole work of the camp as though there was no party leadership there at all, but party organizations existed then just as they do now, and guided all our work according to their conscience. Practical workers only carried out what standing orders, periodic instructions, and operative decisions from above demanded of them. The same people who were working there then work there still. Perhaps some 10% of the personnel are new. They have been repeatedly commended for their work, enjoy a good professional reputation. All on the staff of MOOP are fired with outraged indignation. The spiteful bitterness of this work is simply astounding. He is deliberately trying to turn the people against the MVD. Why do our organs allow people to lampoon MOOP personnel? This is dishonorable. Anna Filipovna Zakharova, Irkutsk province. In the MVD since 1950, party member since 1956. Just listen to it. Listen to it. This is dishonorable, a cry from the heart. For 45 years they tortured the natives, and that was honorable. But someone publishes a story about it, and that's dishonorable. I've never before had to swallow such trash, and this is not just my opinion. Many of us feel the same. Our name is Legion. Quite right, their name is Legion, only they were in too much of a hurry to check their reference to the gospel. It was, of course, a legion of devils. In short, Solzhenitsyn's story should be withdrawn immediately from all libraries and reading rooms. A. Kuzmin, Orel. Withdrawn it was, but by easy stages. This book should not have been published. The material should have been handed over to the organs of the KGB instead. Anon, a coeval of October. Another one who conceals his identity just in case. Who the hell knows which way the wind will blow next? October's contemporary shows insight. It very nearly happened that way. And here's another Anon, a poet this time. Hear me, O Russia, our souls are unspotted, our conscience unblemished. That accursed incognito again. It would be nice to know whether he had shot people himself or merely sent them to their deaths, or whether he's just an ordinary Orthodox citizen. But alas, he's anonymous. Anon, spotless, Anon. Finally, we have the broad philosophical view. History has never had need of the past, and the history of socialist culture needs it least of all. A. Kuzmin. History has no need of the past. That's the conclusion our loyalists are left with. What then does it need? The future, perhaps. And these are the people who write our history? What retort can we make to them all, faced with their massive ignorance? How can we now make them understand? Truth, it seems, is always bashful, easily reduced to silence by the too blatant encroachment of falsehood. The prolonged absence of any free exchange of information within a country opens up a gulf of incomprehension between whole groups of the population, between millions and millions. We simply cease to be a single people, for we speak, indeed, different languages. Nonetheless, a breakthrough has been made. Oh, it was stout, the wall of lies. It looked so secure, looked built to last forever. But a breach yawned, and news broke through. Only yesterday we had no camps, no archipelago, and today there they were for the whole people, the whole world to see. Prison camps. Camps, what is more, of the fascist type. What was to be done? You, whose skill in turning things inside out is of many years' standing, you venerable panegyrists, surely you won't put up with it. You, surely you won't quail. Men like you, give way to this. Of course they wouldn't. The distortion experts rushed unbidden into the breach. They might have been waiting all those years for just this, to cover the breach with their grey-winged bodies and with the joyous, yes, joyous, flapping of their wings to hide the archipelago in its nakedness from astonished spectators. Their first cry, which came to them instinctively in a flash, was, "It will never happen again! All praise to the party! It will never happen again!" Such clever fellows, such expert gap-stoppers. Obviously, if it will never happen again, this automatically implies that it is not happening today. There will be nothing of the sort in the future, so of course it cannot exist today. So cleverly did they flap their wings before the breach that the archipelago became a mirage almost as soon as it rose into view. It does not exist, it will not exist, if you really must. You can just about say that it did exist once upon a time, but of course that was in the days of the personality cult. Very convenient, this personality cult. Trot it out boldly and pretend you've explained something. What manifestly does exist, what is left to us, what fills the breach, what will endure forever, is all praise to the party. Praise is apparently due in the first place because it can't happen again. But very shortly it begins to sound like praise for the archipelago. The two things merge and cannot be separated. On every side we heard it, even before they got hold of the magazine with my story in it. All praise to the party. Even before they reached the passage about how Volkovoy used to lay on with the lash, cries of all praise to the party thundered all around. In this way, the cherubim of the lie, the guardians of the wall, dealt with the first moment of danger. Admirably. When Khrushchev, wiping the tear from his eye, gave permission for the publication of Ivan Denisovich, he was quite sure that it was about Stalin's camps, and that he had none of his own. Tvardovsky, too, when he was worrying the highest in the land to give their imprimatur, sincerely believed that it was all in the past, that it was over and done with. Tvardovsky can be forgiven. Around him, everybody in public life in Moscow was sustained by this one thought. There's a thaw, they've stopped snatching people, we've had two cathartic congresses, people are returning from nowhere and in large numbers. The archipelago was lost in a beautiful pink mist of rehabilitations and became altogether invisible. But I, even I, succumbed, and I do not deserve forgiveness. I did not mean to deceive Tvardovsky. I, too, genuinely believed that the story I had brought him was about the past. Could my tongue have forgotten the taste of gruel? I had sworn never to forget. Had I somehow never learned the mentality of dog handlers? Could I have failed, as I schooled myself to be the chronicler of the archipelago, to understand how closely akin it is to the state, and how necessary to it? I was so sure that I at least was not in the power of the law I've mentioned. As the paunch grows, the memory goes. I did get fatter. I fell for it and believed. I let myself be persuaded by the complacent mainland, believed what my own newfound prosperity would have me believe, and the stories told by the last of my friends to come from you-know-where. Conditions were easier. Discipline had relaxed. They were letting people out all the time, closing whole camp areas, dismissing NKVD men. No, we are creatures of mortal clay, subject to its laws. No measure of grief, however great, can leave us forever sensitive to the general suffering. And until we transcend our clay, there will be no just social system on this earth, whether democratic or authoritarian. So that I was taken by surprise when I received yet a third stream of letters from present-day Zex, although this was the most natural of all and the first thing I should have expected. On crumpled scraps of paper, in a blurred pencil scrawl, in stray envelopes often addressed and posted by free employees, in other words, on the sly, today's archipelago sent me its criticisms and sometimes its angry protests. These letters, too, were a single, many-throated cry, but a cry that said, "What about us?" In the uproar over my story, the press had nimbly avoided all that free citizens and foreigners did not need to know, and the theme of its trumpetings was, "Yes, it happened, but it will never happen again." And the Zex set up a howl. "What do you mean, never happen again? We're here inside now, and our conditions are just the same." "Nothing has changed since Ivan Denisovich's time." The message was the same in letters from many different places. "Any Zek who reads your book will feel bitterness and disgust because everything is just as it was." "What has changed if all the laws providing for 25 years imprisonment issued under Stalin are still in force?" "Once more we are being put inside for nothing at all. Whose personality cult is to blame this time?" "A black mist has covered us and no one can see us." "Why have people like Volkovoy gone unpunished? They are still in charge of our re-education." "From the shabbiest warder to the head of the camps administration, the existence of the camps is of vital concern to them all. The warders fabricate charges against us on the most trivial excuses. The security officers blacken our personal files. Prisoners like me, with 25 years, are their favorite fare, and they gorge themselves on it, these corrupt creatures whose mission it is to exhort us to virtue. They are just like the colonizers who used to pretend that Indians and Negroes were inferior human beings. It takes no effort at all to set public opinion against us. All you need do is write an article called 'The Man Behind Bars,' and next day the people will be holding mass meetings to get us burned in ovens." Kasyukov and Monchanskaya, The Man Behind Bars, Sovetskaya Russia, August 27, 1960. An article inspired by government circles, which put an end to the brief period, 1955 to 1960, of mildness on the archipelago. In the view of the authors, the conditions created in the camps had turned them into charitable institutions. Punishment is forgotten. The prisoners do not want to know about their obligations, while the administration has many fewer rights than the prisoners. They assure us that the camps are free boarding houses. For some reason, no charge is made for laundry, haircuts, and the use of visiting rooms. They are outraged to find that there is only a 40-hour working week in the camps, and indeed that, so they say, prisoners are not obliged to work. They call for hard and strict conditions, so the criminals will be afraid of jail. Hard labor, bare planks without mattresses to sleep on, civilian clothes to be prohibited, no more stalls selling sweets, etc. They also call for the abolition of early discharge, and if a man is guilty of an offense against discipline, let him stay in longer. And they further recommend that when he has served his time, the prisoner should not count on charity. True. Every word of it is true. "You have taken up your position with the rear guard," says Vanya Alexeyev, to my dismay. After reading all these letters, I, who had been thinking myself a hero, saw that I hadn't a leg to stand on. In 10 years, I had lost my vital link with the archipelago. For them, for today's Zex, my book is no book, my truth is no truth, unless there is a continuation, unless I go on to speak of them too. Truth must be told, and things must change. If words are not about real things and do not cause things to happen, what is the good of them? Are they anything more than the barking of village dogs at night? I should like to commend this thought to our modernists. This is how people usually think of literature. They will not soon lose the habit. Should they, do you think? And so I came to my senses, and through the pink-perfumed clouds of rehabilitation, I could make out the familiar rocky piles of the archipelago, its grey outlines broken by watchtowers. The state of our society can be well described in terms of an electromagnetic field. All the lines of force in it point away from freedom and toward tyranny. These lines are very stable. They have etched their way in and set hard in the grooves. It is almost impossible to perturb them, deflect them, twist them about. Any charge, any mass introduced into the field, is blown effortlessly in the direction of tyranny, and can never break through toward freedom. For that, 10,000 oxen must be yoked. Now that my book has been openly declared harmful, its publication recognized as a mistake, one of the consequences of voluntarism in literature, now that it is being removed even from libraries used by the free population, the mere mention of Ivan Denisovich's name or my own has become an irreparably seditious act on the archipelago. But even in those days, even then, when Khrushchev shook my hand and to the accompaniment of applause presented me to the 300 who considered themselves the artistic elite, when I was getting a big press in Moscow and reporters waited in suspense outside my hotel room, when it was explicitly announced that such books had the support of the party and the government, when the military collegium of the Supreme Court was proud of having rehabilitated me, just as it now no doubt regrets it, and the lawyer colonels declared from its bench that the book should be read in the camps. Even then, the mute, the secret, the unnamed forces were invisibly resisting, and the book was stopped. Even then, it was stopped. Only rarely did it reach a camp legally, so that readers could take it out of the culture and education section library. It was removed from camp libraries. If it was sent from outside by book post, it was confiscated. Free employees sneaked it in under their coats and charged Zex 5 rubles a time, or even, so we are told, as much as 20. Khrushchev rubles from Zex? But no one who knows the unscrupulous world about the camps will be surprised. The Zex carried it in like a knife past the search point, hid it in the daytime, and read it at night. In a camp somewhere in the northern Urals, they made a metal binding for it so that it would last longer. But why talk about Zex when the same tacit but generally accepted prohibition was extended to the world about the camps, too? At this station on the Northern Railway, Maria Asieva, a free woman, wrote to the Literary Gazette expressing her approval of the story. And whether she posted the letter or imprudently left it on the table, 5 hours after she had put her opinion on paper, the secretary of the local party organization, V.G. Shishkin, was accusing her of political provocation. The words they think up. And she was arrested on the spot. How this incident ended, I just don't know. In Corrective Labour Colony No. 2 at Tiraspol, the sculptor, G. Nedhoff, himself a prisoner, modelled the figure of a prisoner in his trustee's workshop, in plasticine to begin with. The disciplinary officer, Captain Solodyankin, discovered it. "So you're making a prisoner, are you? Who gave you the right? This is counter-revolution." He seized the figure by its legs, tore it apart, and hurled the halves on the floor. "Been reading too many of those Ivan Denisoviches." But he didn't go on to stamp on it, and Nedhoff hid the halves. On Solodyankin's complaint, Nedhoff was called in to see the camp chief, Bakayev, but in the meantime he had managed to come upon a few newspapers in the culture and education section. "We'll put you on trial," thundered Bakayev. "You're trying to turn people against the Soviet regime." So they understand what the sight of a Zek can do. "Permit me to tell you, Citizen Chief, Nikita Sergeyevich says here, and here's what Comrade Ilyachev says." "He talks to us like equals," gasped Bakayev. Only 6 months later did Nedhoff dare retrieve the halves. He glued them together, made a Babbitt metal cast, and sent the figure out of the camp with the help of a free man. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.